Johnson. I'm Maggie Dawn. She is Anya Esser. We are the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. If you want to join us, we're going to have a lively show this afternoon. 855-75-CIVIC. That's 855-752-CIVIC. So nice to see the sun finally shining on you. How about it?
It is bright out here in Waukesha. That is all I can say. The whole drive out, I was like, man, I got to unpack my sunglasses. Jeez.
Get your sunnies out, everybody.
Oh, yeah.
When I was in graduate school, I had to finish a thesis. Many of you know I'm an economist, so graduate school included lots of data on lots of computer screens. Had to finish a big semester-long paper, spent an all-nighter in a computer lab. It was fall semester. Finished the paper in the morning before you could actually email these into professors. So I had to leave the computer lab, walk it across campus to get it into the professor's mailbox. And I'm bleary-eyed. And, you know, back in the day, so I graduated from graduate school in the late 90s. And pixelization and sort of working, you know, the blue light correctors and things that you have now on computer screens, not so much back then. So I had been, you know, squinting at screens of data all night to get these econometric models to work. Printed the sucker out. You got to proof it. I mean, so I had been using my eyes, let's just say that, a lot. And some snow had fallen overnight because it was fall semester. And then the sun came out and I had to get it into the prof's mailbox by 8 a.m. I walked outside with this paper, you know, in triplicate. I had to put them in that way back in the day. And it was just this bright ball of sun reflecting off of all the snow. For those of you that ski, et cetera, or hike in the snow blindness, it is a real thing. Walked outside and my eyes started literally like pulsing in my head because I had been, you know, looking at this different kind of light and squinting and data. And I came back the next semester and started to give my professors grief. Can you please write more clearly on the chalkboard? The whiteboard, can you use some block type instead of cursive? And my classmates all said to me, Maggie, you need glasses. I said, what do you tie of 20/20 vision? Ha ha. Not after that little outing. So please, folks, I say all of that long story to say, be careful out there driving. You go in west or east on 94 here in southeastern Wisconsin, a lot of the other state highways, you're going to be getting a lot of sun in your eyes. Please be careful. It seems like no matter which way we slice the weather cake here, talk about mixed metaphors, folks, here in Wisconsin, you got to always drive carefully. But I'm certainly enjoying rolling into the weekend and some Brewers action with a little sun on our faces. We've certainly been waiting. It was snowing yesterday morning. I mean, this is vintage Wisconsin, is it not? But that's not the only good news this Friday. We also had some incredibly, what I'm going to call good bad news. I'm going to mostly focus on the good. Coming out of the Florida Donald Trump documents case. Now, just brief refresher, and then I'll set the stage for this particular legal wrangling that's going on. This is the case, probably the most straightforward of all of the Donald Trump prosecutions. This is, you took classified national security documents home with you after school, and you're supposed to leave the school supplies in the classroom. They're not yours to take home. Donnie, you need to leave those in the White House, technically with the National Archives. But yeah, he took documents home. Some of these highly sensitive plans about what we would do if we were attacked by certain adversarial foreign powers and the like. So this was not, you know, he made some doodles on a page and decided to take that home. Nor was it the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association's map of the hurricane that he decided had to absolutely hit Georgia. And so he took a Sharpie and expanded the route of the hurricane. It wasn't stuff like that. It wasn't arguably past tense, not no longer relevant, or otherwise sort of maybe tier three documents. No, no, folks. These were our defense plans. Some of the most sensitive documents that a nation could ever possess. That's what Donald Trump decided was his and took home. So that's the Florida documents case. Remember, this is what sort of kicked off what then became what felt like nearly monthly indictments of the former president, the raiding of Mar-a-Lago, where we found, you know, in the ballroom on the stage, boxes of confidential documents stacked up in the bathroom, boxes of confidential documents. Hey, Anya, I know where to keep my nation's most sensitive military secrets.
Oh, yeah?
In my bathroom.
Oh, yeah. That makes perfect sense. Keep them in the half bath where they can get wet when someone takes a shower. That's perfect.
It's just the risk of the toilet overflow. I mean, cheekily, right? I don't think I'd want to go into Donald Trump's bathroom, personally. So perhaps, in a way, secure. But we joke. And it's not really a joking matter at all. But yeah, we've all seen these pictures. Nuts. Nuts. And making matters worse, of course, it wasn't just the taking of them and then the putting of them haphazardly in ballrooms accessible by members of the general public or, say, planted agents of foreign governments that happened to buddy up to Donald Trump and others in his circle, like Lev Parnas. It wasn't just that, right? It was the fact that the FBI and the Department of Justice and the National Archives had for months been asking Donald Trump to turn these documents over. Are you sure we've gotten them all? Please go back and check. And we'll send a formal letter to your attorneys. Hey, we're going to send a subpoena. You really have to turn these over. It's very important. This could be a crime. Please turn these over. Tick-tock, months roll by. They're still not getting the documents. They have a final meeting with his lawyer. Say, we're going to have to come get the documents if you don't swear that you've turned them all over. And Donald Trump tells his lawyer, no, don't worry. Meanwhile, told his body man and a bunch of people that worked for him at Mar-a-Lago to pack those suckers up, put them on an airplane from Florida up to New Jersey and Bedminster, and let's put the documents there. Move this stuff around. Which is what us lawyery types called a clear indicia of a guilty conscience, right? Why would you move the documents if it was totally fine for you to have them? So that's the factual predicate. Again, this is probably the most straightforward of any of the criminal prosecutions against the former MAGA president. Now, here's what's really crazy. Y'all remember or have read about Richard Nixon. Some litigation about presidential immunities, in fact, happened before the Supreme Court. And one of the outgrowths of the Nixon scandal of Watergate was the enactment of what is called the Presidential Records Act in 1978. The entire purpose of the Presidential Records Act was to limit and restrict in federal law what a president can call his personal records. Because there was an argument floated for a while that Nixon, oh, the tapes I made, that's just for my, those are for my personal records, right? The very Nixon tapes. But here's what. Basically, every document that is touched or created or edited or reviewed by a president, his calendars, his emails, his text messages, anything that his administration does, those are all presidential records. Basically, the only things that aren't that would be, I'm going to my niece's birthday party calendar entry. Stuff like that. Everything else basically was deemed in the Presidential Records Act to be the public's documents. And therefore, the Presidential Records Act required preservation of all records. It required that those records be turned over to the United States Archivist, to wit, the National Archives. And the only way that you could dispose of a document. So it's either personal, and basically nothing's personal if you're the president. It's either personal or it's a public record and it has to be preserved. Or if a document has zero, not at all debatable, administrative, historical, informational, or evidentiary value, it could potentially be destroyed. Now, there are a single document may actually be covered by numerous different laws. Here's where we start to get into what's going on in Florida, right? You could imagine a briefing document that comes from one of our national security agencies, say the CIA, that comes into the president's hands, is presented to him in the Oval Office. He's handed a copy. It's marked highly confidential. And he's briefed on it in the course of his daily duties. Now, that document could likely be covered by numerous different federal laws. In other words, a single document isn't just subject to the Presidential Records Act. That document may also be covered by the Espionage Act if it deals with national security secrets. So not only does the Presidential Records Act, which has nothing to do with criminal law, it merely lays out effectively the procedural and logistical and the legal status that applies to records created during a presidency. Are you with me? So it's a civil, those are civil laws. They have nothing to do with criminal penalties or criminal law at all. This is how you process documents when an administration ends. Here is what is presumptively a public and a presidential document. Here's the tiny little, very restricted post-Nixon, post-Watergate category of personal documents. And of course, documents can be covered by other laws like the Espionage Act, which is a federal criminal statute. Okay? So these security briefing documents, these defense plans that Donald Trump took with him to Mar-a-Lago, had his lackeys try to hide so federal agents wouldn't find them, stacked up in his bathroom, all that kind of stuff. Those documents, not only covered by the Presidential Records Act, in other words, you got to turn them over, but also covered by the Espionage Act. We're going to be back in just a minute. I'm going to dive into why Judge Aileen Cannon is an idiot. You're not going to want to miss it. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show on the Civic Media. I've heard it before. Yeah, the dinners were nice till your diamond words melted into some ice. You should have been rapping to the beat of my song, Mr. California, paper gangster raw. I'm looking for love, not an empty page full of stuff that means nothing but you pimp a lady. Cause I do not. Welcome back, Wisconsin. I am Maggie Dawn. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show, and I'm talking about what an idiot federal judge Aileen Cannon is. She sits and presides in Florida. She's the one hearing Donald Trump's criminal case down there. I love the fact that I can finally say that, like, out in public. She's an idiot. She's a terrible lawyer. She's a terrible judge. She's a partisan hack. Does that mean that there probably aren't other idiot partisan hack judges that are liberal out on the federal bench? No. But they're not overseeing a criminal case against a former president for taking our national defense secrets with him to show off to reporters and God knows who else. So I spent the last segment trying to explain and share with all of you this idea that, yeah, something can be covered by the Presidential Records Act and what the purpose of the PRA was, again, post-Watergate, to basically tell presidents that nearly every document and record that you create, touch, receive, see when you are a president is a public record, not meaning it's open to the public, but it is presumptively the public's. It is not your personal property, and it must be turned over to the National Archives. So a document can fall under that rubric, and it can also be covered by the Espionage Act. Specifically, 18 U.S.C. Section 793 sub E, which makes it a crime to have unauthorized possession of any document relating to the national defense and willfully retain the same and fail to deliver it to the officer or employee of the United States entitled to receive it. Yeah, you know, like what Donald Trump did. That simple. Now, here's what happened in Florida that is so bananas, and why I can say with such certitude at this point that Judge Aileen Cannon is a partisan hack and a terrible lawyer. So we are months and months out from a trial. And she directed both Jack Smith and the prosecutors, as well as Donald Trump's defense team, to draft jury instructions. Say what? We don't even have a jury. We're not even close to trial. There's going to be all kinds of wrangling about who gets to see what documents, when and why. Because again, we're dealing with national security secrets. So this is weird that she asked for this. It's weirder still. So like, that's level of weirdness one. Doesn't happen. Level of weirdness two. She's like, okay, and when you draft the jury instructions, the, you know, just for my consideration, I want you to draft two versions of them based on the following hypotheticals. And Anya, it's not a gotcha quiz. I'm going to ask you what you think the commonality between these two hypotheticals is. Hypo one, draft jury instructions where the jury decides whether these records were Donald Trump's personal property or public property. That's hypothetical one. Hypothetical two, that she instructed Jack Smith and defense counsel to write jury instructions, assuming, was that the president has the sole authority to decide whether a record is personal or publicly owned.
Huh. Well, I guess the commonality there would be that those... feel like those things aren't up to those people that we're discussing.
Anya, you're smarter than Judge Aileen Cannon.
Wow.
If you're all screaming at your radios or your smart speaker or YouTube or your computer, all places where you can catch the Maggie Dawn Show, you're smarter than Aileen Cannon, because what is baked into those two hypotheticals is this, that the Presidential Records Act didn't already decide that these are public records. And further, that the Presidential Records Act has anything to do with the Espionage Act. It doesn't. It doesn't. The Espionage Act is a criminal statute. It doesn't matter. Even if you could somehow construct a tortured argument that our national security secrets were somehow Donald Trump's personal property, they're not. It doesn't matter. They're national defense documents, which I'll read again under 18 U.S.C. Section 793 says it's illegal to have unauthorized possession of any document relating to the national defense. And by the way, nothing in the Presidential Records Act says, well, the president can just deem something a personal record. And in fact, President Obama, in Executive Order 13526, that's 13526, came up with a standardized process to declassify or classify and otherwise safeguard presidential records. So my point here is this. This woman is an idiot. You don't ask for jury instructions this far out. And you do not ask for jury instructions premised upon these two legal fallacies, which is the status of a document under the PRA is somehow determinable by the president himself or the or jurors. It's not. The entire purpose of the PRA was to take that discretion away from presidents because Richard Nixon. The second fundamental legal fallacy is that somehow, even if it was covered by the PRA, and somehow, even if it was a personal document, that it wouldn't still be a violation of the Espionage Act. Wrong. She's an idiot. She's an idiot. And she's a hack for Donald Trump. Basically, everybody's saying it now. Like, even conservative lawyers are saying this. And that her interpretations, the way that she's handling this case, is such an abrogation of her duties. Such a violation of basic process in our judicial system that she should be removed from the case. Usually judges are removed from cases when they have a conflict of interest. Here, now lawyers, even conservative lawyers, are saying she's so bad, she's such an idiot, that Jack Smith has got to find a way to get her off the case, or that the 11th Circuit, the appeals court who sits above Aileen Cannon, should basically remove her from the case some way, somehow. Now, there's all sorts of procedural details about how those things might happen. We're not going to go into those right now. Because the absurdity of where we are is ridiculous. And Jack Smith and his filing in response to this stupid request from Judge Cannon built upon two stupid legal fallacies said, listen, we shouldn't be writing jury instructions. We need a ruling from the court about whether or not the PRA even applies here. And by the way, it doesn't. And in response to that, she called it, I want to be sure I get the language right here. She called it unprecedented and unjust. This is a person who asked for exactly what she got and then has the audacity to whine about it. So not only is she a partisan hack that's gumming up our judicial processes, not only is she an idiot when it comes to the law, she's also whiny. We all should be concerned about this because someone so deeply unfit to rule on one of the most important criminal cases of this century, of our lifetimes, should not be permitted to continue to oversee this matter. She has got to go, but guess who's got to stay? I am so excited. I'm going to be joined by Chef Kyle Kanawha because it is Foodie Friday and we're going to have some fun here on the Maggie Dawn Show. He is the executive chef and owner of Birch Restaurant. Much lauded James Beard Award finalist right here in Milwaukee. That's Birch Restaurant's Chef Kyle Kanawha coming up next after your farm report in the news here on the Civic Media. Welcome back, Wisconsin. You are listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I am super excited to have my next guest join all of us. I'm joined this half hour by Chef Kyle Kanawha, executive chef and owner of Birch Restaurant just off of Water Street in downtown Milwaukee. Welcome, Chef Kyle. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me on the show, Maggie. Super excited to join today.
Wonderful. I got to tell you, I have had two of the best meals of my life at your restaurant in the last 6 months.
Oh, wow.
So I just want to thank you for that. Eating really fabulous, enjoyable, inventive, different food. It can be really transformational. And I was able to celebrate some really big moments. And your food and the atmosphere at Birch really made them special. So a personal thanks to you.
Oh, that's so exciting to hear. And congratulations on those big moments again.
Well, thanks so much. Kyle, you have been celebrated in so many different ways. A two-time James Beard Award, finalist, most outstanding chef, 22 and 23. New York Times, 50 best places to eat. Birch Restaurant, which is just so freaking awesome. I love bringing this kind of attention to Milwaukee. But as kind of a fangirl of Top Chef, I have to say I was so pumped, one, that Top Chef is celebrating Wisconsin and especially Milwaukee. But I was just watching a couple of the first episodes, saw you sitting at the table in the Miller High Life Caves enjoying a dinner on Top Chef. How was that experience?
I think there's like two parts about it. The seeing the Top Chef production and being a part of that was just incredible. But doing it in the caves just made it like surreal, you know, like super. I mean, it was pretty amazing to see. And not to be a spoiler alert, but I am on a later episode as well. But that one in the caves just will be a memory that I cherish forever.
Wonderful. I look forward to seeing more of you on Top Chef. Now, you're from Birmingham, Alabama.
Right.
What brought you to Milwaukee? How did we get here?
So my wife grew up in Brookfield.
Ah.
She actually moved to Alabama when she was younger. That's where we met. And then, oddly enough, I followed her to New York in 2007, right after we actually started dating. And I was young. I think I was 21, and it was an opportunity to move to New York and learn learn in other restaurants in the city. And so I followed her there back in 2007. And then I followed her here in 2020.
Well, we are so glad to have you and your wife back in the good land, as we like to say here in Wisconsin. I myself moved to New York in my 20s. I know you used to work at Gramercy Tavern, another one of my absolute favorite places to eat in New York. Can you share a little bit what the experience is like as you're coming up as a chef working? I know you worked with Chef Stitt in Birmingham, who has this connection to sort of what became the vanguard of French cuisine and its infusion into the way that we eat in the United States. At Gramercy Tavern, you helped really put Maysville on the map in New York. What's it like going through these steps as a chef and working in these places with a lot of different range, a lot of different cuisine styles?
Right. You know, I think like the main thing that I talk all the time about, so Mike Anthony is the chef of Gramercy Tavern. And then, like you mentioned, Frank Stitt from Birmingham, they're two very similar, similar minded chefs from different places. Mike Anthony, like, trained in Japan for a long time, trained in France. Frank spent a lot of time in France, but the way that they approach American food, and they always talked about, and that's how we like the conversation to go here, Birch, they always talked about American food and letting that be the center of what we cook. And that what that really meant was like using ingredients from the community around us and supporting the community, and letting that be the driving force behind how we cook and operate. And there's all those similarities always. So it made it really comfortable for me to move from Birmingham to New York and work for Mike. And it made it feel like, okay, I know what's going on here. And of course, in that move, a lot of different exposure, bigger environment. But I felt really comfortable with what I was taught to kind of step into those roles. And then eventually to move on from Gramercy and open my own restaurant, finally, called Maysville. And then we opened a restaurant in New Orleans and called Kenton's. And all of those restaurants, I think you could kind of see some kind of similarity and like guiding light from how we cook through them. So I always kind of just trusted that and supported what I thought what was right, and just kind of kept my head down and moved along.
Yeah, when I was researching for our interview, one of the reviews in the New York Times of some of your food really resonated with me. It was called both refined and unpretentious.
Right.
And in my thinking and in my palate, not, you know, I don't mean to project my taste on anybody else. I think that's kind of the heart of what I think of as the highest order of American cuisine. It's approachable. Right. There's something in it that you know that seems familiar, yet it's refined. It's taking you to a different way of enjoying something that might be a little bit familiar and kind of pushing your food experience in a way that becomes a bridge for your next meal. I love the way that food has that bridging element, not just to cultures, but the way that our own palates expand over time. I wanted to ask you, when you think about your own culinary journey and your palate, is there a meal that stands out or a taste that you've had that just kind of one of those mind-blowing moments where you're like, wow, what was that? Completely unexpected, either in cuisine style or a particular plate or a particular bite of food.
Yeah, I mean, I think the common thing, like you're saying, is like food has so many like types of memories, from taste to smell to feel, you know, and like, you know, I'll smell something and like it'll bring me back. It's one of the like strangest things I think I've ever connected, and I couldn't believe my brain could do it. We use these spices from a friend of mine called Burlap and Barrel. And when I first smelled this black lime powder that he makes, this was like 6 years ago, probably. I was with my chef de cuisine, John Kim, at the time, and we just tasted through all these spices, and I just kept on saying, this black lime powder, there's something there that I like, it smells just like something. And I finally figured it out maybe a day later. I had gone with my brother and sister-in-laws to Napa for a long week. And we went to this winery, Arista winery, and this one Pinot Noir, for some reason, I was like, this powder smells just like it. But I think the point of that is like, it's just crazy how like your brain can like store these things away that you don't even really think about. And so, you know, in terms of your question, I think like there's definitely been times when I've eating like the have eaten the most soulful, amazing pasta somewhere. And like the way that that made me feel, like how soulful it was and like how luscious it was. Those are things that I think about when I talk with, you know, the cooks that are making the pasta at Birch. Like, let's make sure that like when we're making this pasta, it's a fresh pasta. So the dough doesn't need to be served al dente. It should be this softer, more luscious thing that, and now the cook that makes it, his name is Eric. When he makes it, he says like, you know what? It's kind of like a warm hug. Mm. And I think it's like discovering those moments and being able to like use those thoughts and memories to create food moving forward.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I am a carbohydrate junkie of the highest order. You put before me like a really great dessert and a bowl of perfect buttery noodles. I'm yep. going for the noodles every time, oh, yeah. especially yeah. if I got fresh pasta, right? That's one of the things that I really think some people, unless you experience it or somebody's talking to you about it, folks may not know. And that is both your smell and your taste are these sort of reptilianly wired senses right. in your brain, and they will make connections to things and evoke feelings and emotions and connect you to experiences in a way that our other senses just don't. It's at this whole other brain level. And I think that's what can become so powerful
right.
about but, food moments.
Yeah. Well, I think the coolest thing is like, I feel like so many people I talk to, they're like, you know, I don't have the experience of knowing great food and eating fine dining food and all that. It's like, it's none of it, or like tasting great wines and stuff. None of it is like, I think, true knowledge. I mean, it can be, but a lot of it is just like the experience of tasting something and like remembering that. Like, and I think that's more important than like, than knowing all the information about a certain wine or a certain technique or something like that. It's like anyone can understand food because it's taste. And like, if something tastes good, there's no argument. And it's like you kind of store that memory away, and it's like, yeah, now you have the experience of like tasting that. So, you know what, you know, a good squash tastes like, you know. So yeah. I think that's the coolest part about it, is like you can't argue with something when it's delicious, and that's like anyone can experience that.
I was talking with a chef friend of mine a number of years ago, and we were kind of in the same space. How do we make and encourage people to, you know, try something new? Don't be intimidated by it. Order whatever you want. Talk about it. You don't have to know right. the fancy words. Just right. try it yeah. and eat it. I think about food. I'm a lawyer by trade. I think about food. I also have a degree in economics. The same way that I think about law and economics. And stay with me here for a moment. That is that lawyers and economists will use buzzwords and lingo. Mm-hmm. But if you really know it, you don't need that to make right. it accessible.
Right.
And I think food in a lot of ways can be that. Like, yeah, if you're trained in it, you can have these fancy conversations. But when it really connects, there's parts of the law and parts of economics, just like there are parts of food,
sure.
that should just connect with you innately because of your human experience and should right. make sense on that level. I love that you brought up, hey, folks, just go try the food. Don't worry. Right. If you've never done it before, it's there right. for you too.
And I mean, and the more you do that, the more your those memories and tastes that you've kind of stored away. And like, that's what it's all about. And like, people, so I have two kids, a 9-month-year-old daughter and a 4-year-old son. People always ask me like, oh, does Aiden, does he, you know, is how does he love to eat? What's his palate like and so forth? And I mean, he eats everything. He eats, you know, hamburgers, fries, chicken nuggets. And the funny thing is like his mom, my wife, will like make him eggs in the morning and he won't eat them. And he says, you know, these aren't daddy's eggs. And like, he'll eat my eggs. And they're not fancy. They're just like, I've cooked them the same way for him forever. And now he has that kind of thought of like, those are better. And that's like,
that's the way I like my eggs.
Yeah. And it's like a very basic thing, and they're not fancy. You know, it's nothing fancy. It's truly like some great farm eggs scrambled and that's it. But it's like, he's tasted them and tasted them and tasted them. So now, you know, now, yeah, he likes the best eggs in the world, as he says.
That's amazing. One of the things that has always concerned me, you know, for all of us here in Wisconsin, but more broadly in the United States, is that I think fewer and fewer of us have the opportunity to eat really fresh food.
Right.
So much of our agribusiness and what we find on grocery store shelves has traveled quite a distance.
Right.
If for somebody who's trying to build their at-home ability to make good food, in addition to farmers markets, where are good resources to find where good local purveyors of produce and proteins and those kinds of things are, so that people can access and have that really great fresh food at home?
Right. You know, I think that's you know, for sure the biggest issue is the accessibility for people. But I think just thinking of terms of like healthy eating, you can eat canned beans and grains and frozen beans. Like if you go to Pick and Save, there's frozen butter beans. If you cook those at home, like with a piece of bacon and like an onion, oh, tastes delicious. Yeah. That's what's, I think people, it kind of goes back to though, of like people I think can be a little intimidated. And there are things like that, if you can be shown, that can make things more accessible and delicious. And I think like healthy is by far like more important than being delicious. But honestly, I think normally they go hand in hand.
We can do both. Yeah. Yes, we can do both. Guess who isn't intimidating? Chef Kyle Knoll of Milwaukee's Birch Restaurant. We're going to take some important messages, come back with Chef Kyle, talk about some of his favorite things to eat. Keep it locked, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio.
WAUK and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK, Waukesha's home for Up North News Radio. When I die,
Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I try to do it as frequently as possible because I love talking about nothing more than food. I've got Chef Kyle Knoll of Birch Restaurant just off of Water and Pleasant Street in downtown Milwaukee joining me. We've been talking about your approach to food, your thinking about food. One of the things that just consistently leaves me in awe of chefs that put out the kind of plates of food that you do, Chef, is the weight of doing that every day, right? Especially once you start to get some recognition, awards, these nominations, and all of a sudden everybody's a freaking critic, at least so I've been told. And that in many ways, you go out there every day and you're trying to hit perfection every day, every plate. How do you gear yourself up? How do you get the energy to do that every day? It seems very daunting to me.
I think honestly it sounds like a lazy thing to say, but it's like truly just so fun 95% of the time for us that it's not, it's like I think nothing makes us happier. You know, like since it's spring break right now, we've had a few slow weekdays, and like last night our restaurant was full and we all were like, oh, we feel normal. Like this is what we love to do. And like, I always find when I travel away on vacation, I get back and my first like night back in the kitchen during dinner service, tasting food, it's just so pleasing and makes me so happy to taste the vegetable. It's always about a vegetable too, which is so funny. I'll taste like a carrot. I'm like, damn, this carrot is just, I haven't tasted anything like this in a week. And like, it's those little things that add up to a great experience that we're giving to guests, but it's those little things that add up for us that just, I think, bring so much joy to us.
I really, again, my accolades to you and every one of your colleagues cooking and chefing at this level. You're putting out something that is so deeply personal that again, you're inviting people to comment on it, to experience it, and you're doing it every day. I think that's just an incredible amount of chutzpah, if you will, sure, in going about your work. I certainly am a happy benefactor of that work. You mentioned traveling. When you're traveling, what's your favorite way to connect with the food of the place that you're in, whether it's a place you've never been or a place you've been a bunch of times?
You know, I think like there's kind of two parts. I always, since I was a kid, like I remember going to the farmer's market with my mom. It's something that as a, you know, as a kid, it was important. Becoming a chef and working with my mentors, it was important. I always love going to, obviously, the farmer's markets, no matter where you are, which always kind of actually becomes an issue, because if we're somewhere for like 3 days and we go to a farmer's market, we buy way too much produce. But those are the things that obviously are like super delicious. But also, like when we travel, I think traveling can be exhausting, and like eating out in restaurants can be like, it can, you know, it's a lot of food and it can be rich and it can just be a lot. So I always actually find it more relaxing if we can be somewhere when we travel where we can make some food at home, even if it's like a breakfast or a lunch. But definitely like on trips when we can hang out and relax or on a table is always, I think, the more enjoyable time.
And when I travel, I have a full fridge rule. Basically, I can't enjoy my trip until the fridge is fully stocked and I know that I can be making midnight snacks and and some food for folks to bring us all together and take a breath. This is a silly question, but it's one I like to ask folks because I've got a particular favorite. I like to ask chefs, what's your favorite hot sauce or condiment? It doesn't have to be a hot sauce. A lot of folks really dig on the hot sauces.
Right.
Do you have a favorite condiment?
I mean, I definitely love mayonnaise more than anything, like jarred Hellmann's, especially, you know, obviously we make a ton of different mayonnaise at the restaurant. We use it a lot in different ways and stuff like that. I also love yogurt. I use yogurt more than I use sour cream at home. Mm. And I love Tabasco. I don't think there's anything that competes with it as far as hot sauces go. The acidity and just the depth of flavor that it has is really nice.
Yeah, Tabasco's got that tang.
Yeah, right? And like you can use it like when we make, if I make like a cheese sauce or something, or I always put Tabasco in it and it acts as the acidity in something like that. And
which you need in those fatty things like a cheese sauce.
For sure.
I love that you love mayonnaise.
Yeah.
Not Miracle Whip, mayonnaise. There's a difference, folks. Yeah, I don't mess with the Miracle Whip. I am a strictly mayonnaise kind of gal myself. Just for whatever it's worth, when I was in Belize, I had not had Marie Sharp's hot sauces until I actually was there. Mm-hmm. And though, if you really like hot, her habanero hot sauce really does kick it up a notch. That'll clear your nostrils right out if you're having a bit of a sinus congestion. Given that you're not from Milwaukee, what is your favorite thing about being a chef in Milwaukee?
Definitely the farming community that we have access to. We go to the West Dallas Farmers Market when it's in season, like Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, like every one of them that it's open. And meeting those farmers and getting to know them has helped us cook what we want to cook. So that for me is by far the best part about having a restaurant here in the city.
I love to hear it. Obviously, we broadcast across the state and there are so many folks listening that live in farm communities. And I probably don't say this half as much as a professional eater, which I'd like to call myself. None of that happens. And I don't get to eat the amazing food that I do at places like Birch Restaurant in downtown Milwaukee on Water and Pleasant Street without the farmers in this state of Wisconsin and the incredible work that they do to give you the raw materials to make the great plates of food. Right. We only have about a minute left. I wanted to ask you, what is your tip to everybody to be a good diner in restaurants?
Just be open to enjoying it, you know, and I think it's a full experience. Like we want Birch to be a place that sounds fun, looks fun, tastes great. And it's like, I think just go into somewhere and be able to be taken care of and enjoy yourself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I sit down in a restaurant, it's like a time where like, I don't care what's going on outside in the world or outside the doors. It's literally a time to sit down and forget about everything.
I love that. I'm sorry. We got to let you go. Thank you so much, Chef Kyle. A real privilege, highlight of my week to talk with you this afternoon. That's Chef Kyle Kunal of Birch Restaurant in downtown Milwaukee. Back with more in just a moment.